So we were in the middle, right? We had noted that many, if not most, probably most, of the Rishonim were comfortable with the idea that Chazal could be wrong about science, and that's what they're telling you here, right? But we started noting, right, started going through the approaches that weren't so comfortable with it. Now, we had only done the what Rice Lifkin calls the apologetic acceptance, right? Which was the idea that, yes, they're allowed to be wrong, but they were only wrong because such studies were beneath them, right? Which is the idea that, but as we said it last week, right, there is a certain logic emotionally why you would want to say something like that, which is, yeah, right? So the example we'd given last week, Rudy's not here, right? But Rudy, right, that, yes, he has great respect for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So primarily, yes, if it turned out she was bad at understanding the law, that would completely undermine his faith in her. Fine. His faith in her. This is a religious language. I don't want to use this. Right? But his, whatever, his respect of her. There we go. And if she was wrong about something completely inconsequential, it wouldn't. But if she was wrong about something consequential, even if it's not her field of expertise, it could diminish it. And that's why you could understand why someone would be uncomfortable. I will just point out that the major assumption here is the idea that, like, understanding how the world works is beneath Chazal, which is not something that I think, like, the Rambam would have said at all. So one of my friends asked me last night, or to me 2 days ago, we've been having a long discussion about an article that's, like, formulating in my head, but the upshot was he asked me, do you think that poskim have a chiyuv to understand, like, the upcoming sciences? And I said, well, what I said to him was, I said, look, I would say yes, but let me be, there's tzvei dinim in that. One is they have a responsibility to understand science, to understand the world, no less or more than any other Jew / Talmud Chacham, for whatever reason you think you have to understand science, with the Rambam, it's Avad Hashem, or whatever model you have. But poskim, and this is where I would say, I really disagree with this idea. I didn't say it last week, but now I have a sharper formulation in my head. It can't be beneath you. Maybe this, because it doesn't really have practical implications. But if science that has practical implications, it cannot be beneath a posek. The responsibility of a posek, a good posek, is to be on top of it and maybe even be ahead of the game and see what's coming down the road. Like, if you realize that something is going to shake up society, and you don't try to understand it, you are simply not going to be, right, prepared, right? To my mind, right, the two most major sciences, I'll just say this parenthetically, scientific / technological advances that poskim would be irresponsible, but I would say are, you know, not being quite as responsible as they need to be about these things are AI and genetics, right? Broadly speaking, right, is genetics, genetic modification, epigenetic modification, all the things around that, because, right, these are the technologies that are going to be hugely disruptive, already beginning to be hugely disruptive, and, like, they need to understand this practically, right? So for me, right, even though they're not experts in this, if a POSEC made a little mistake, I mean, everyone makes mistakes, but if I understand this emotionally, if I saw a POSEC I really respected, and they have literally no idea what's going on in genetics, right? Like, they haven't the slightest idea of the implications of, let's say, CRISPR, right? That bothers me, because especially opposing who's involved in, like, medical ethics. He didn't know what CRISPR is. He doesn't know the potential for gene editing that's coming or is, and it's going to get more, right? Like, so for me, so maybe I could buy, like, theoretical things like this, like, how much did it affect them, whether the sun went over and under. So, like, yes. For me, if a post-sake that I really respected said, look, I don't really understand quantum mechanics, and I have no opinion on string theory versus whatever, right? Whatever other theories you want instead of string theory, and I have no opinion about quantum gravity and blah, 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 I would say, okay, fine, right? I mean, you'll find it interesting and it'll inspire you about the greatness of God's world, but you don't get it. Okay. Maybe that's what's going on here. I don't think it's beneath them, but, like, I get it. Okay, you don't know everything. No one knows everything, right? I would just say that I wouldn't buy this if it was something that had practical implications. Then I would just say, I will think less of you as a post-sec. I just will, right? Like, it's not that I won't think of you as a great person, but I would think less of you. It does bother me when people don't engage. Good, I got that off my chest. Good, okay. I didn't really. It's the article in my head that is thing that will get it off my chest, but it is so long already, right? In my head.
It's like,
no, separate. That's it. That's there are a lot of things going on in my head right now.
It's like
right?
Yes,
like Ray Carmi's TV show, right? Exactly. But I do need to get this out. My friend was like, "Would you like me to co-write it? Will that help you get it on paper?" I'm like, "Maybe, honestly, if I just get, I just get the ideas." I like literally sat there. I was like, I basically wrote it on WhatsApp. I'm like, "Here is the flow of the argument. Here are the makara they need to go. This is what." And then I was like, "This is not working." I sent it a 7-minute voice note. I'm like, "Okay, here is my thesis. Right? This is where I'm going. I just need to spell it out." Yeah.
It's also a little funny that if there's such little value, that the Gemara would be.
Correct, even though sometimes the Gemara has things which are like, whatever, but the Gemara seems to think it matters. Right, you're right.
And also in terms of not being by the way, Kosek not knowing something like that, but just in terms of, I think as you mentioned quickly, in terms of knowledge of God and God's
correct.
Word, that you should still.
Right, so it happened to be that my friend asked me as Kosek, and I said, look, science, like theoretical science, or just understanding the world, that is, I think, a Posick doesn't have a more of an obligation than anybody, right?
Everybody.
That's what I said. I said, there's the Posick qua Jew, / Talmud Chacham, / whatever. And then I think Posick can be even more. When things are practical, yeah, it would shake my faith in, it would shake it. It would lessen my appreciation of that Posick, right? Or I'll put it differently. The Posick, like when I was reading a book called Future Morality, which is basically an article by a book by ethicists who basically made the claim I just did about Psak, but about ethics, which is that a responsible ethicist needs to see what's happening and get out in front of it and basically set up ethical frameworks for the tech. Even though if we don't know the exact contours of what's going to happen, but we see where it's going, we need to set out frameworks because otherwise it'll get here and we won't know what to do ethically. And I sent it to Rabbi Turchiner, and I said, who was the Rosh Kol in Toronto I worked with, right, worked under. And I said, here's a few topics I really think, like he gives medical ethics shiurim that are recognized by Ontario for continuing credit. I was like, some of these are really important issues. And the reason I have so much respect for him was he immediately sent me back a flyer. I actually spoke about this on the Jew of the Future series already a few months ago. I'm like, yes, this is why I have so much respect for him because, right, he thinks that way. We have to be thinking like this, right, is we need to be getting out in front of it and saying, okay, this is, the world is changing. We need to understand. Okay, but that, let's move to another one. So the next methodology is the textual reinterpretation model. That's what Rice Clifton calls it, which is the claim that that Chazal were right, and in the extreme form, not just they were right, but they had to be right. Right? What? Oh, yes. Oh, they contradict themselves. Right? So what drives the Ramah to say something? So first of all is the fact that, yes, there isn't practical implications to this, but there sort of is, right? The Gemara, well, not practical. The Gemara goes through this in other places and assumes, right? Like the Gemara we saw briefly in Bava Batra, where it assumes the same assumption, the sun and the earth and etc. And he notes that many midrashic allusions point to the idea of the world being open on one side, meaning it's not, right, for what bothers the Ramah is that it isn't just a localized thing. Like, Chazal build on this, and if you say this is wrong, then everything they say is wrong.
Well, that's a fallacy. Saying just because one thing they said they're wrong doesn't mean everything they
said. No, but all the things that hang on this... So then he goes through a whole explanation, and he basically comes to the idea, I'll read you a summary. Ramah proceeds to argue that the Talmud's description of the world being open as the northern side is referring to the line tracing the sun's path around the earth, which would be invisible, i.e. open on the northern side, since the lines pass below the horizon of that part. His justification for claiming the world word Olam refers to the orbital path of the sun, and the Talmud statement, the world is open to northern side, is that the existence of the world fundamentally depends on the existence of the sun. Okay, and he goes through this, but even if you don't buy its exact interpretation, which I'm not sure I even follow the astronomy of it, right? But why does he need to come up with a way? So here's the key. He says, behold, I say that the words of our sages, may the memories be for a blessing, are built upon the true wisdom, and their words contain nothing perverse or crooked, even though sometimes at first thought it seems they do not accord with the words of the scholars, which are developed via proofs, especially in the field of astronomy. And some scholars, in disputing the sages, support themselves, which that's what they said that the Gentile scholars triumphed over the sage of Israel. But some people think the raya that Chazal can be wrong is that Chazal said they could be wrong. But that's bad. This is also the words of the master of the guide, who wrote that science of astronomy was not fully developed in the days of Rambam. And that's the Rambam. But one who investigates it will be shocked to say that the sages, may their memories be for a blessing, did not know these matters. A person who is concerned for the honor of his creator and the honor of the sages of the Torah will not think thus, but rather will be meticulous with their words. Right now, he goes through different explanations, right? Again, I'm not sure I follow all of this, right? He, again, none of it is based on astronomy that we know anything about. But, so what do we take from the Rambam? So I'll first read your Eislifkins and you tell me what you think. So he, after going through the exact ones, you can read it if you're interested in the exact defense he comes. One is that the apologetics are screened, as other people noted. Right, sorry, DeRossi noted this. And it's remarkable that the Rambam went to such great lengths, even when Chazal themselves acknowledged they were wrong. The second is that the Rambam never actually deals with this passage, right? Like he, right? Like in all of his rhetoric concerning, right, the status of the sages' pronouncements and apologetics to hold them, he surely could not have accepted the Jewish scholars were in error regarding the sun's path at night. But it's difficult to see how he could possibly explain away their words and the consequences regarding water and wells. And even with his view that the word rakia refers to the earth rather than the firmament. And then the most puzzling, is that in the Torah Ha'olah, he just says, oh yeah, Chazal were wrong. Right? The Gentile the scholars triumphed over them. So what exactly, so what are we supposed to do of this? Right? So what he suggests is the following. Returning to our mind, perhaps the question of why he strained himself with apologetics can now be answered. Ruderman notes that it's unclear to what extent Rambam pursued his astronomical studies simply as a way to understand various Talmudic concepts and to what extent it reflects a genuine interest in the sciences, or at least an accommodation to the fact that astronomy holding a privileged place in the larger environment of Krakow, which he proves earlier on here. Davidson argues that Rambam was simply involved in harmonizing disparate texts rather than displaying any genuine interest in science for its own sake, while Fishman considers that Rambam perceived its religious value in studying the laws of God's creation. Langerman, while essentially agreeing with Davidson, observes that Rambam's goal with these textual harmonizations was to address serious doctrinal problems such as Aristotle's eternal universe. Consistent with this understanding of Rambam seeing science and natural philosophy as a threat to the faith that must be countered, we see that the topic of the sage's potential fallibility in astronomical matters, Rambam is very much on the defensive. Right, so it could just be that, yeah, one of the things that's going to push people is when something becomes polemical, right? When something becomes, and maybe that's why, right? Maybe he didn't fully believe it. Maybe in certain contexts he was willing to accept it. Okay. Here he goes to other people who accept the alternate astronomical model. You can go through all of it, but I will be honest that, you know, it's not like I'm a great visual thinker, but the visualizing wrong versions of astronomy, it gives me a little bit of a headache. I'm like, there's Yishgvul, right? Yishgvul to this. Okay. But there is a totally different approach. The totally different approach is to say it's not a problem. Chazal aren't wrong, because they can't be wrong. But rather than try to defend it like the Ramah, what do they do? You tell me. If you don't want to say that Chazal can't be wrong, either you want to say that Chazal can't be wrong in science, or to be fair, you just don't care about it. What could you do to this Gemara?
They weren't wrong. They were just applying what they knew as
hello. No, come on. Very good. Right, as if you really want to dodge all the problems, you could say, oh, forget it. It's a metaphor. Now guess. Take a wild guess. Who's just going to look at this Gemara and say, aha. How'd you know? You're a genius. Right, Maharal just looks at it and says, Mashal. Right? Mashal. Okay. Now what... reading as a mashal, I will point out, can accomplish one of two very opposite things. Right? One is to prove that, is to say the rabbis cannot be wrong. It seems like they're wrong. No, you don't understand. This is all one big mashal. The other extreme is...
the mashal is trying to teach you that.
No, the other thing is, maybe they could be wrong. But that's... it's just not talking about it. And the truth is that I could imagine someone saying, sure, it's a mashal. But the fact that the Agadata tells B'derech Mashal the rabbis admitting they're wrong comes to teach you that whatever is going on, they still think they could be wrong. So the fact that you take it as a metaphor doesn't automatically tell you anything about whether someone thinks Chazal can be wrong or not. What? Yeah, like, right, he'll say, no, you're right, it's a drash, but the shot of the drash is that Chazal think they can be wrong, right? You could say that, right? You could, so that's not what Maharal does, but you could have done that. I will point out I see no reason this Gemara to do that. None. I see no reason to do this whatsoever. It's like telling me to read all the medical stuff in Gittin as a mashal. When you get to it, I will tell you the psak of Rosh Hechter at the beginning of the Sennacherib and the Bishop.
Is that when it talks about the deal with
it's all types of, like, two blot of these medical stuff. When I was in YU, my first year we did Gittin, someone asked Rosh Hechter, what should we do with it? And he's like, ignore it. And they're like, then someone asks, can we make a siyum on Gittin with just not looking at those dafim, just skip it? He's like, yes. Like, it's them recording their science. It's wrong. It's not Torah. It was them recording it. Let's move on. Right? My compromise was I art scrolled it. I was like, okay, whatever. So what will it cost me? 20 minutes, right? You just read through all of it.
It was mostly just like art scroll because it was never
correct, right? So that's my compromise approach. And all these things was like, okay, just read art scroll. It's interesting, but I'm like, I'm not gonna try to like break my teeth over with Jastro. Is like, what is this? I'm like, I read the English. I'm like, and. You could have told me in Hebrew, Yiddish, French, Latin, you know, English. It's all the same to me. I'm like, what are you talking about? Right? I have no idea. I give you a head there. Just art scroll the whole thing. It's like two blot. Okay? You know? And if you want a Posner Shech, then who am I to say no? I remember if you were like, really? You could make a seum without ever looking in those dapim? Gittin has gone from being 89 blot to 87 blot? You know, like, whoa! Okay. I don't think it's really so surprising. If it just like, yeah. I mean, I could see why someone seems surprising, but knowing like Rosh Hechter, right. He's like not afraid to say something like that. Like, okay, like the Gaonim say ignore their medicine. So like, why should I not ignore their medicine? That's what the Gaonim said to do. Like, okay. So the Maharal takes it as metaphor. Now let us try. We will try to understand his metaphor and see what goes. So first it's clear though for him why is he using a metaphor. So he tells you very simple. He summarizes it and he says, this cannot be contradicted by any intelligent person, right? Meaning the way that the world actually is, you can't contradict. And therefore he says, it can't be the Chazal were wrong about something that's like Roa Beinayim. I will be honest, this doesn't bother me at all because, yes, as I said, it would diminish my faith in someone if they made a mistake that was completely, right, that was easy, right? Like if someone, right, wrote down, I originally thought that oranges were purple, and then I looked at an orange, I'd be like, please don't write that down. That just makes me have less respect, right? Less respect for you. If someone said, I originally misunderstood the effect of... methylation on DNA, right? Because but then I studied it deeply and now I understand the different types of methylation and I understand epigenetics, I'd be like, okay, that's fair. I mean, right? Like, that's fair.
Most people don't get it first time around.
Exactly. No, I'm thinking this because like a few months ago I took out excellent book, The Epigenetics Revolution, to learn about it. And I, like, okay, I get it somewhat, but I'm like, I'll be honest, like, some of this is a little bit complicated for me because it's visual and I'm just, like, not a visual thinker. So then I happen to notice in, like, on my, you know, in the Libby app, a graphic novel, two epigenetics. And now I'm actually starting to get it. So it's just put in epigenetics. I got it. It's just a picture book, like, going through it of the gene. Like, not a graphic novel. It's a graphic, but it literally just, okay, this is the gene. This is what it looks like, right? And I'm like, okay, now I understand it, right? I don't think, like, okay, so it's complicated, like, you know? That's really good. If you want, like, that's a really good book. That, like, really got me into it. I didn't understand, like, everything, but now the visualizing has helped me get it. Like, the concepts I got, but actually seeing pictures of, like, you know, where methylation happens and things like that is actually quite helpful. It is a good book, though, Epigenetics. I thought it was very good. I can look at what the exact name of this is, like, Epigenetics. It's like a graphic book, I think is what it's called. And it's literally just pictures. And it's, I mean, it's not. It's very detailed science, but with pictures along the way of what it looks like. And, like, joke pictures also, but, like.
The Epigenetics in the Age of Twitter.
I did not read that. Interesting. Okay.
Hazalia were also correct for believing
this. Yeah, right. Know. That's the thing, is that I'm not, like, I'm just not bothered by this morale problem because, like,
right.
He's like, how could they contradict you? Achush roe. Like, no, they didn't.
Right, like, you can't blame much of gravity when in 1,000 years we realized gravity was stupid.
Right. That was an interesting example to pick. But sure, right? But yeah, like, you can't blame someone now for thinking that string theory makes sense when obviously it doesn't. But, like, great scientists think it's true, but it, as we know, it's not even wrong, right? But Ginsburg and I happen to share the opinion here that string theory is just, like, in our non-expert opinion.
Robbie, you can't disprove
that. I know.
That doesn't mean anything.
That's, thank you. And according to Karl Popper, that would make it a non-scientific theory, right? Because scientific theory depends on the ability to falsify. No, I'll find what it was called. Wow, we are getting far afield here. Okay.
Well, you sort of can't if you did something
which is okay, good. Fine. Now, right now, Rice Lifkin makes the point that I just said, which is, oh, come on. Like, you can't say that, oh, they couldn't have made a mistake because it was obvious. It wasn't obvious. Chazal were allowed to make mistakes about things that are not obvious. What is that, Chazal? Right? If, honestly, right? I will be honest that if let's say a Haredi Posek, who I do not expect to have gotten an advanced degree in science, were to come out and say, you know, give a 10-minute, you know, break out in the middle of their shiur and say 10 minutes about why they believe in string theory, right? My first reaction would not be, why is he believing string theory? It'd be like, oh, wow, you know about string theory enough to talk over 10 minutes, right? Even if I disagree with you, I'm like, I understand there are very, very smart people who know a lot more about these things that believe in string theory. El chatai ani maskir hayom, right? I can't bring myself to believe in it. I could be wrong. Yeah. Anyways, it was actually very funny when we were at CERN 3 years ago and, like, they gave us basically this, like, wizened old gadol of quantum mechanics. He was, like, you know, 90 years old. Like, he's been doing this forever. And he was just like, yeah, I have a different theory of all of this. But it will be proven whether I'm right or wrong in, like, 4 months. The experiment's been going on for decades, and we will finally know. And we're like, okay. Like, we want to find out. What? I don't know, ask Ray Ginsburg. Maybe he
would have heard of that.
Ray Ginsburg got his card. He's like, oh, I'll check it, you know. He was like this, but it was like, this is hysterical. It was so funny. It was amazing. Anyways, so, but Maharal says, okay, fine. And these people want to consider the words of the sages, yet they have not grasped their meaning at all. For if the opinion of the sages was that the sun passes through the sphere at night, and travels above the sphere, they would not have said that the sun travels above the firmament, but rather that it travels above the sphere. Just as they previously, that the sphere is fixed and the constellations resolve. So he makes a diuk, right? What drives him to believe this is that Chazal use different words, rakia, and right, and the Galgal. So you see they're using specific words, which means that there's something symbolic about those words, because physically they're the same. Okay, right? Again, here, right, Slivkin points out, the Rambam probably said they're basically synonymous, so use synonyms. Sea anemone. What are you doing?
It's like Finding Nemo.
You're trying to get me to enunciate. Did
you ever watch Finding Nemo?
Yes. Pasha. I feel like Finding Nemo is one of those like classic movies that are like kosher amongst Yeshivish people also, because like it's like, you know.
Who is Nemo? Nemo's the Easter Tov. Is that how you find?
You know, he's the yeah. So Maharal here says the firmament is not physical. It's a separation for the between the material and the spiritual realms. Rather, the concept of the spheres and the concept of the firmament are distinct from each other. The firmament refers to that which is the firmament for the lower regions, and this is called firmament in the words of the sages, and that is the firmament which is mentioned in the Torah, for the word firmament is never used for the sphere. And now the opinion of the sages who said that during the day it travels below the firmament, and at night it travels above the firmament, means that during the day the sun is found in the world, and the firmament is the beginnings of the lower region, and the sun travels below the firmament during the day together with lower regions. But at night, the sun is separated from the world, and it is with regard to this that it said the sun travels above the firmament, meaning the firmament which is the beginning of the lower regions. I'm going to skip to the next paragraph. But you should know that the sages were not speaking about this, except insofar as their intent was that God, who separated between those that are on the earth below and those that are not on the earth and are above, and the firmament separates with them, and therefore the sun that God gave to the day to illuminate the earth travels below the firmament, and the firmament does not separate from the sun in the lower regions. But at night, when he did not give the sun to illuminate the earth, therefore the firmament which God gave to separate between the upper and the lower regions separates the sun from the earth. Maharal is stating that because God did not want the sun to illuminate the earth by night, therefore its spiritual essence is removed from the earth at that time, traveling above the firmament, which results in the sun disappearing from view by passing below the horizon. Okay, that's the upshot of the Maharal's. Only during the day, when God wanted it to illuminate the earth, did he permit its spiritual essence to be exposed and for it to travel below the firmament. Right, and then he says, so then what did the Chachmei Umar HaOlam mean? That the spiritual essence of the sun had to be restricted to day so as to not overpower the earth, and it therefore travels above the firmament. Right? So according to the Chazal, both of them agree that the sun manifests itself in the world when its spiritual essence is relevant. The difference is whether you think that it's not relevant at night or it's too relevant and it would overpower the earth. That is the machloket. And then what does it mean when it says their words are more correct? So then the Maharal says, okay, that's great, except the Gemara says that this explains why wellsprings are warmer at night than by day. Someone want to explain that one? So he says, it is true, for the waters themselves are suited to steam at night, in that the sun travels opposite the sea and rules over the element of water. And during the day, it is the opposite. Okay? Ah. Right? So the power of the sun doesn't manifest itself in the world during the night. It does in the water. Right? Meaning that the reason that the wellsprings steam at night is not because the sun is there, but because the sun's spiritual essence is there. I will now quote Rabbi Slifkin, because I will admit that I agree with him pretty much verbatim on this, which is, I must admit that Maharal's approach is incomprehensible to me, especially in terms of correlating with the fact that the earth is inhabited on all sides. Okay? I am now at a loss to understand what this means metaphorically. Like, I literally just don't know, because, yes, the sun manifests itself during the day, but in Australia the sun doesn't. I Then he claims, I don't know whether this is true, but he says, Maharal's approach even seems to be apparently incomprehensible to dedicated students of Maharal's work who failed to explicate his view. And then he notes that Rabbi Adlerstein, in his English adaptation of select portions of Berah Gola, omits the section entirely. And Yehoshua Hartman, who's the major commentator of Maharal Alive, he's in England, and he wrote like amazing footnotes on Maharal, if you ever want to understand it. Like the footnotes are unbelievable. And since I've started learning Maharal, it's invaluable. He just knows he doesn't really explain. He said the only person he found who actually explains Maharal is the French Algerian philosopher Henri Adlan in Enlightenment to Enlightenment. And then he says, unfortunately, his elaboration is scarcely less cryptic. So I don't know what to tell you.
Okay.
But here's the questions you want to deal with, right? Is one, does the Maharal realize how novel his approach is? Right? Does he realize that basically most of the Rishonim didn't care to just say Chazal were wrong?
Did he say that they can't be wrong? Or did he just put
them in the so that's the interesting question, is I'm not actually sure, right? I'm not convinced here. Meaning, like I said, when you say it's metaphorical, that could lead you to three different conclusions. One is that they can't be wrong, so anything that seems to say they're wrong is wrong. The other is that they could be wrong. It's just that in this case, right, they happen not to be wrong. Right, or you take, you know, a metaphorical approach and you really radically, and you basically just assume Chazal really aren't talking about Matiyah in general, right? Like, I have no opinion whether they could be right or wrong. That's just not the plane at which Chazal function. Right? So the metaphorical approach, I'm not convinced the metaphorical approach is only adopted. Right? Slifkin seems very convinced the metaphorical approach is only adopted because people think Chazal can't be wrong. I'm not sure. Right? It could be that this particular case they don't, or it could be that in the case of the Maharal, as we've seen, the Maharal is just a metaphorical reader. Right? He just is. And even things which could very well be pshat, the Maharal is very into imagery and metaphor. So I'm just not convinced. Now, the truth is that, right, Slifkin now, has a second article here in terms of his both explication of the Maharal's revolution to Agadat and what he doesn't like it. He calls it Maharal's multiple revolutions in Agadic scholarship. I'm actually very sympathetic, not to Maharal here. I honestly don't know what he's talking about, but to Maharal in general, right? Meaning, I am open to saying that a lot of things are not metaphorical, right? But the Maharal happens to just be a very fascinating metaphorical reader, in general, right? A very brilliant reader. So I'm not convinced that the only thing driving Maharal here is right? Slifkin is very convinced that basically in the last 400 or 500 years, there was a major epistemic shift from people who thought that Chazal could be wrong. Right? And then people saying they can't be. That might be true, right? I'm just not convinced that every person who says that something is a metaphor, that that's what's going on, rather than their assumptions about Agadah in general and metaphor, and right? You never know. Right? It was like when I was talking to Rainer Sklarishir has been doing the question about Chazal, what we do when our science doesn't match up with Chazal. Right, and my simple point that I made to, I think, to Spicer was that, look, he asked me my opinion. I said, my opinion is that each sugya has to be taken on its own merits. Because in some sugyot, I think Chazal are making a Metziut claim, and I think they can be wrong. In some sugyot, they seem to be making a Metziut point, but they're not. And in some cases, I really do believe in Nishtano Ateva. And this is not because of some magic thing. There are cases where it's literally Nishtano Ateva. Right? It's not because I don't think Chazal can be wrong that I say Nishtano Ateva. And he was like, really? What case? I'm like, very simple. It was like Chazal say that a woman cannot become pregnant, right, and will not become a nida for 2 years after childbirth, right? That is Nishtano Ateva. Nothing metaphysical, right? Ad Hayom, we know that, right, if you look on the American government's right website, they will tell you that for the first 6 months of having a child, if a woman exclusively nurses, that is considered something like 97% effective as a birth control because the nursing tells the body not to ovulate, right? But after 6 months, we start introducing babies to food, right? And we have good nutrition, so the body heals faster, right? But in the time of Chazal, where there isn't baby food and there isn't formula, and people aren't as well nourished as we are, so what's true for us for 6 months was very likely true, right? Because they said, standardly, you wean the baby at two. And if you only wean the baby at two, and almost all of their food until two is coming from you, you're malnourished, then your body, right, the woman's body will tell it, right, will tell the body, don't ovulate, right? It's not, right, that's literally, right, this is not Chazal, right? Right, wrong, it's purely descriptive, right? So my feeling in general is that you can't come up with a single approach on halachic questions of science, on philosophical questions of science, and you do have to judge it. Just because they can be wrong doesn't mean every time it looks like they're wrong, you jump to that. Yeah.
In that case,
which case? That one?
Just the one right now, about 2 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think what you're saying is that the laws...
Correct. It's not that the laws of nature changed. It's
application.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, literally. Like, not the laws of nature changed. Like, it, there used to not be gravity, and now there is. No. It's that... It used to be that on average it took women about 2 years to get them. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I don't think that's what people generally mean.
No, I understand they don't. But that's what I said to him. I said, sometimes I literally believe Nishan Vateva.
Right.
And not because I think that nature changed, but because, like, yeah, like, nature people's, right, eat differently and nurse differently and, like, their bodies changed. I mean, not crazy. Yeah, no, I'm not saying. I'm not saying that the metaphysics of woman change. I didn't say that, right?
That.
No. My point was just that, right? If I say that in certain cases, yeah, the reality has changed. In certain cases, I believe, right, that Chazal can be wrong. In certain cases, I believe that they're not speaking about Metziut, really, right? That's not a contradiction. Like, you just have to take each case by itself. Okay. All right, Slifkin, though, notes that whatever exactly Maharal reads... in the last, like, 400 years or so, this idea becomes much, much more popular. And he notes here, Rav Menachem Azaria Defano, right, the Rambam Bipanau, the Ramchal, Rav Pinchas Eliyahu Hurwitz of Vilna in the Sefer Habrit, the Nitziv, distinguishes between the physical sun and the spiritual force of the mazel of the sun, states that the sage of Israel in their dispute with the Gentile acknowledged the sun's path at night, referring to the spiritual sun, but they did not reveal their intent as their way in matters of sanctity. The Ben Shchai. Now, here he notes that at least some, even if not the Maharal, the popularity of this for some is that they don't believe Chazal could make a mistake, right? And that's why they go to metaphor, because that makes them impervious. Now, like I said, in the Torah science questions, right, you will see certain posts go this direction. So, for example, right, Rav Eliyahu Dessler goes in this direction and says, yeah, the reason that you can still kill a louse on Shabbos is because they don't mean that it actually spontaneously generates. They mean... it's not seen to the naked eye, so it's as if it's spontaneous rage, which they're not willing to say that they were wrong, right? But that leads to the halacha staying the same, right? Okay. The most extreme view, there is yet even one more extreme view, and that is what he calls scientific vindication, which is basically the position that Chazal thought they were wrong, but Chazal were wrong about being wrong, because Chazal are always right.
Well, that
yes. So this is the position he quotes of Rav David Gans, Rav Yom Tov Yilman Heller, and Rav Yosef Del Medigo. Right, he notes that Gans basically goes through the Ptolemaic, Copernican, and Tychonic cosmological systems. And basically what he wanted to do, right, his goal here was to say that, you know, Chazal were ahead of their time in science, and everybody comes away with saying, oh, their original view was actually right, and then explains it.
They didn't know, but they weren't aware that they can be wrong.
Basically, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I don't really understand how this helps. I'll be honest. I'm not Meachos sure about this. right? The Tosfot Yom Tov says there's a well-known dispute from the time of the ancient rabbis of blessed memory whether the stars move and the sphere is fixed, or whether the sphere moves and the stars are fixed. The view of our sages of blessed memory is that the stars move and the sphere is fixed, and Scripture supports them. For after it is written, God made the two luminaries, Scripture explains that he placed them in the firmament. It may be seen from this that the luminaries are distinct entities rather than being made of the firmament itself. This correlates with the view that luminaries are that which moves and that the sphere is that which is fixed. The luminary is an entity that is separate from the firmament and it moves in orbit around the firmament. Right, so basically for him, the key is that Chazal recognized that the sun, the moon, and the stars are separate from the sky itself, and therefore they were right. Then he has this long discussion of Rav Delamigo. Right, and basically says as follows. Right, that he writes explicitly this: the life of my head, the sages of Israel did not act appropriately when they abandoned their opinion. Right, they were wrong to say they were wrong. I mean, that's literally what he says. With regard to the sphere being fixed and the constellations revolving, except the opinion of the Gentiles, for in our time, most scholars have disqualified that which they accept and adopted that which they have negated. It seems to be that the argument for this position is a desire to believe that Chazal are not just infallible, but like predicted modern science that they couldn't possibly have known. And therefore, what's weird to me about that position is that in order to say that, they're willing to say Chazal are wrong about the idea that they could be wrong.
Right?
Like, they are more committed to the idea that Chazal intuited the truth of the world before anybody else than they are about Chazal. Yes, right? Chazal are allowed to be wrong about thinking that they're wrong.
They're like smarter than they realize.
Right, they're smarter than they realize. Again, I wonder just how much that is of them being born in a world where science is beginning to challenge religion, right, for superiority. Right? And therefore, to come back and say, no, like, we know this first. Right, is a very powerful emotional thing. And I wonder that's what's really driving them. I don't know. There is one more approach. And then he quotes from Rabbi Yosef Ashkenazi, and I don't really need to explain this too much to you, but basically, which is reject science. Just say, reject science.
Who says that?
He quotes Rabbi Yosef Ashkenazi from Poznan Livorno Svet. He was a staunch anti-rationalist. Yeah. He says he was a staunch anti-rationalist who fought against the study of philosophy and the adoption of the philosophical model. Included in this battle was a polemic against the entire Ptolemaic cosmology, .. And therefore he says, yeah, Chazal only meant that it seems like the sages are right, but like what seems doesn't matter because like... Correct. Right now here, for him, it seems that his desire was more to discredit Ptolemaic cosmology. Okay, so, right, but here, now just to conclude it, right, Slufkin notes, and I agree with him, right, is that what's most interesting about this sugya, less than what any given person thought about the sun and moon and stars, is the pattern of interpretation and the way we think about epistemology, right, where what's most important about like the Rambam's view is that he thought, A, that Chazal really care about things like science, and or be totally open about being wrong about things that matter, right? And then the fact that starting in the 16th century, people start to become less comfortable about it in whatever way they were, right? So either people like the Abarbanel who say they're wrong, but they like are apologetic about it because, right? Again, is that because science is becoming more important? Science is starting to challenge religion, and therefore, okay, they can be wrong, but like it hurts to say something like that? Or do you say, no, like science matters and therefore they can't be wrong, right? Is it, or do you say science doesn't matter, that's my solution, right? Or no, I need to show the dominance of tradition over science and therefore not only are they right, they were wrong with the fact that they were wrong, they were always right, right? But we actually predict it, right? You see, right, how the question of what you take, it's not just about this local thing, right? It is... it's a major question about right, how you think about knowledge, the relationship between you want to call Torah and science, you want to call it empiricism and Torah, right? Empiricism in religion, right? Whatever it is, right? It's a really packed, it's really, really loaded, right? And you can see why there is such a difference. Now, why is it? So now Rice Lifkin speculates. What is the difference? Why is it that the Rishonim were so much more comfortable? Right, big adol, whatever approach, but you see that these more creative approaches, you know, appear in the Acharonim. What is it? So he says one possibility is just that we know the Acharonim in general, you know, talk more about like deference to earlier authorities, right? They just do. So it could be that. But Reis Lifkin concludes with what I think is probably right, is that no, it's the last 500 years have seen the that meteoric rise of. Right, science and scientism, right? Meaning the power of science, its ability to challenge religion, right? And therefore, right, it's not just, right, where like science was important for the Rambam, right? But the idea that like science was anti-religion or potentially could usurp religion, that wasn't quite, hadn't emerged yet, right? But the idea that emerged, now how much it emerged is an interesting question, right? Again, you can read Paul Dickens' book, which is still sitting on that, right, on the shelf. But it's definitely part of the story. And like in the 21st century, we know that, right? The idea that like science, the myth that science stands against religion, even when, you know, half of scientists or something are believers. But the idea, right, when you read a Richard Dawkins, you read a Sean Carroll, right? It's as if anyone who knows anything about science knows that religion has been proven wrong, right? When you live in a world like that, to give in might be a sign of weakness. Honestly, I don't buy it, right? I would say no. The fact that Chazal cared about it and were open to empiricism, right? If, you know, if you're a student of Karl Popper, right, then you know, right, I mentioned before, but what was Karl Popper's idea of how do you know that a scientific hypothesis is true? His idea was you don't, right? The only thing you can ever do is a scientific hypothesis has to be something which is falsifiable, and something becomes stronger the more you try to falsify it, and the more it is impervious to being falsified, right? The fact that Chazal are willing to make claims that can be falsified and accept that they're wrong, to me, shows that they're engaged in science. They're engaged in empirical studies. To me, that's, you know, amazing. I don't think that someone being wrong, but really trying and really, like, getting to the nitty-gritty, like I said, if I saw a posek who came and was really clearly in the nitty-gritty and, like, was trying to, you know, imagine what is genetics and epigenetic studies going to look like and setting out, you know, a rubric, and it turns out that they're wrong, I don't look at that person and say that weakened my faith. It's like, look, here's a posek and he really engaged in science and was willing to put himself out there, so he was wrong, right? For me, that gives, right, a tremendous amount of respect, but I understand the emotional reason why certain people would say, like, how can you say this matters? And they're wrong. What if they're wrong about Torah? But Lidati, I don't see the problem because, like, the truth is, look, you know, there's no less in Torah. Like, if a posek, you know, goes out and says something and turns out he's wrong, but he really articulated his claim, it turns out there was some fatal flaw and people pointed out, if he then says, I'm sorry, I was wrong, right? Like, to me, right, that gives me faith that they're actually engaged in pursuit of truth, because being engaged in pursuit of truth and things that matter means that you're engaged in something where you might be wrong, right? No one's going to be right 100% of the time. But I do agree with him that probably, as a guess, as a good speculation, the reason that people started to become uncomfortable with this was this idea that everyone's sort of, you know, and definitely, right, if I saw someone right now write an article to come up with a metaphorical one, right, you understand why, because every time they see that religious leaders are wrong about science, it's like, gotcha. Right? The fact that the scientists also got it wrong for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, right? That's like forgotten, right? It's like, you know, right? But, right, it's like this gotcha. And again, that's Paul Dickens' point with the apocryphal story of Galileo dropping the two things, right? The two balls off of off the Tower of Pisa. See, we show you that Aristotle's wrong, right? Because they drop at the same rate, because it's not about their inherent full ability. It's about, right? And as he said, this is garbage, right? It's a story we like to tell because it shows that religion doesn't experiment and doesn't care about truth, and science does, when he points out that we have no evidence of this. We have evidence of the opposite, which is that people who wanted to disprove Galileo did the experiment and turned out that it came out exactly as Aristotle predicted because of air resistance. Right. Right? Obviously, if you did it, the experiment would not come out the way it is, right? The correct way would prove Aristotle, right? If all you had was that experiment, right? Like, but people love that story because it shows that religion is, right, not empirical and doesn't care about data and is just making claims that are not falsifiable, and science cares and we can experiment and prove. When, like, right, it comes from misunderstanding of what religion is doing, of what science is doing. And that it's not bad to be wrong when you're actually engaged. Like, you can be wrong. We can all be wrong. But, okay. Let's leave it at that. I'm debating whether to do one more week on this Gemara, not the science side, because this Gemara also becomes important for Rishonim and how they understand Gadata in general. Maybe I'll do it next week. Maybe I'll do it in 2 weeks. Maybe I don't know what I'll do. I haven't decided. But let's stop with this one now, and hopefully this discussion at least, you know, got the juices thinking. Like I said, I definitely didn't want to give him a card. I wanted to set up the models and talk about it because it really is important. I think, you know, for me, what's really important about just talking about it is recognizing that we're coming to this at a time when religion and science are presented as if they're at loggerheads, and therefore, I hope we can at least understand the emotional pull to deny the Chazal could be wrong. But I think Lidati, it's all that more important to articulate why, right, those of us who, like me, are sympathetic to the Rambam, why we don't think that lessens Chazal, right, and why we think that makes them greater. And I think to be able to articulate to ourselves and to other people is very important, because we need it in a world where, yes, every time religion, right, gets something wrong in science, it's used as, you know, as a proof that we don't really know what we're talking about. Whereas for the Rambam, be like, no. This proves that we do, that we care and that we're actually enjoying it. And we recognize we can be wrong. And the fact that we recognize we can be wrong, but we're actually in pursuit of truth and nevertheless believe in Torah because we actually believe it's true, even with our rational and empirical hats, right, on, and our scientific hats on, right? We shouldn't let the other side win polemical points on us that way. Right, which is saying, no, we do care about truth, we do care about experimentation, and nevertheless, right, we think, right, and I can give you, you know, a host of books of people who make that point. So, like, Steve Meyer does a really good job of pointing this out in his book, right, The Return of the God Hypothesis, right, which is basically a 1,000-page book where he just says, look, talking about God, it's not something you can prove by induction or deduction, but he says, but you can argue for it based on abduction. And then goes through why he thinks that rationally it's true and why empirically through abduction it makes sense. Abduction is just a fancy way of saying is the best inference from the evidence, right? Meaning that we're not claiming I can prove it, but we're claiming I can make arguments in which I would expect to see X if Y were true. I can't prove it, but it's not, but I am caring about experiment. I am caring about Mitzvot. I am doing the hard work. And what I like about the book, he's just unabashed about it. He's like, no, I'm not saying this because I don't care about science. It's because I've thought a lot about what epistemology is, and I know it's not induction. I know it's not deduction, but don't tell me that that's not okay. It's abduction, and let me explain to you why abduction is a good methodology, and let me explain why within that model, right, I believe in God, right? And that's why he calls it the return of the God hypothesis, right? Because what he's saying, not to say it's only a hypothesis, but to say that he's treating, for him, the question of whether there's God with the same rigor and the same methodology what a scientific theory, right? And I think it's important to be able to articulate that to ourselves. Okay.